Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Union of Concerned Scientists Recommendations Conference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later today, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If you should require assistance during today's conference, you may press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone to speak with an operator. Finally, as a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Now, I would like to introduce your host for today's conference, Elliot Nagin.
Thank you, Daniel. Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Nagin, and I'm the Media Director here at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Thanks for joining our call today. This afternoon, two UCS nuclear experts will discuss our top recommendations for ensuring the safety and security of U.S. nuclear reactors. Some recommendations address problems that came to light during the crisis earlier this year at Japan's Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility. But many of our recommendations address problems that have been festering for decades. UCS has been a nuclear industry watchdog for more than 40 years, but we are not for or against nuclear power. Our goal has always been to ensure that the industry operates its reactors as safely as possible. To that end, we have produced a steady stream of reports. In 1985, for example, we issued Safety Second, a critical evaluation of the NRC's first decade, which documented the fact that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission routinely failed to enforce its safety regulations. 25 years later, some of the problems we identified then are still very much in evidence. As you know, late yesterday, the NRC's post-Fukushima task force delivered its 90-day report to NRC commissioners. We'll take questions about that report during the Q&A session after we present our own recommendations. This afternoon, our speakers are David Lochbaum and Edwin Lyman. David is the director of UCS's Nuclear Safety Project. He is a nuclear engineer by training, and he worked at U.S. nuclear plants for 17 years. He also has worked as a reactor technology trainer for the NRC. Edwin Lyman is a senior scientist in the UCS Global Security Program. Ed has a doctorate in physics and is an expert on nuclear plant design and the environmental and health effects of radiation. After our speakers are done with their brief presentations, we will open up the phone to your questions. Please ask only one question and, if necessary, one follow-up. And please mute your phone after you ask your question. Otherwise, the sound of your typing will make it difficult for everyone else to hear. Finally, if you are having trouble getting everything down that you need from today's briefing, we will be posting a transcript and an audio file on our website later today. I will now turn over the phone to David Lochbaum.
Thank you, Elliot, and good afternoon, everybody. Before Ed and I summarize our eight key recommendations, I wanted to identify the four parties who share responsibility for implementing these safety and security recommendations. Our recommendations are steps the Nuclear Regulatory Commission should take. By law, the NRC's mission is to protect public health and safety. That mission is not accomplished until the NRC ensures these recommendations are successfully implemented at all nuclear plants. But there are three other important actors. First, there's the nuclear plant owners themselves. There's no law preventing owners from voluntarily implementing any of these recommendations. If safety is their foremost concern, as often claimed, they'd back up those slogans with ready acceptance of these safety and security upgrades. Second, the U.S. Congress controls the NRC's budget, giving it ample leverage to make the NRC become the aggressively effective regulator the public deserves. If the NRC is lax or remiss, the U.S. Congress should compel the NRC to become the public's guardian. And finally, the President appoints the five NRC commissioners. The President must appoint qualified persons with an unwavering commitment to safety that is demonstrated by their actions rather than by their speeches. I'll turn now to the first of our eight key recommendations, extend regulations to cover severe accidents. This recommendation entails two parts. I'll cover part one, and then Ed will add the second part. The first part is recommendation number two from our broader list of recommendations, namely, the NRC should require reactor owners to develop and test emergency procedures for situations when no AC, alternating current, or direct current power is available for an extended period. Fukushima demonstrated the disaster that can occur at a nuclear plant when it is deprived of power for an extended period of time. It doesn't matter how many motor-driven pumps or steam-driven pumps are installed if there's no power to run and control those pumps. The NRC's recommendation 4.1 would require all U.S. reactors be designed to cope with loss of AC power for up to 8 hours and to have plans in place to deal with a loss of AC power lasting up to 72 hours. And the NRC's recommendations 8.1 through 8.4 seek to strengthen the value of emergency response procedures. Collectively, these NRC recommendations, once done rather than on the to-do list, may satisfy this first part of our first key recommendation. Here's Ed Lyman for the other part of this key recommendation.
Thanks, Dave. I'd just like to address the survivability of equipment in beyond design basis accidents. After Fukushima, the NRC and the industry claimed that there was equipment available at all U.S. nuclear reactor sites that could have been brought to bear if such an event had occurred here in the United States and would have been able to avoid the outcome that occurred at Fukushima. It turns out that simply wasn't the case. Much of this equipment, which is referred to as B5B, according to the particular regulatory order that they were originally mandated by, that equipment was not designed nor was intended to survive severe events like earthquakes or beyond design based flooding. So that equipment simply could not have been relied on if a Fukushima-type event had occurred here. We believe that the expansion of the scope of what's considered a design-based accident would automatically bring that type of equipment into a regulatory regime where it would have to be highly reliable through inspection, maintenance inspections, and enforcement. It is not clear from our brief cursory reading of the NRC's task force report whether or not their recommendations would go as far as ours in ensuring that equipment would be available if needed. I'll go to the second recommendation, which has to do with emergency planning. As was widely reported, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission advised Americans living in Japan within 50 miles of the Fukushima plant to evacuate, whereas back home, evacuation planning only covers a 10-mile zone. We think that the NRC's recommendation was prudent, and it has actually been borne out and justified by the level of contamination that has occurred in Japan, where there are regions that are contaminated severely well beyond 10 miles from the plant. So we believe that there needs to be, finally, a science-based approach toward designing the emergency planning requirements for each site, depending on issues like population density and site meteorology and other site-specific factors, and that those analyses would necessarily lead to larger and differently shaped emergency planning zones than the 10-mile concentric circle that now applies. I'd like to point out that the NRC's calculations that which they made public defending their 50-mile recommendation in Japan show that there would be exposures to radioactive iodine that would cause doses exceeding the Environmental Protection Agency's protective action guides 50 miles or more from the site. So their own analyses demonstrate the need for protective actions, including evacuation, potentially administration of potassium iodide, much beyond 10 miles. And that concludes number two.
This is Dave Lockbaum again. I'll pick up the next three recommendations. Our next key recommendation is to move spent fuel to dry cask. This is the fourth recommendation from our full set of recommendations, which states that the NRC should require plant owners to move spent fuel at reactor sites from storage pools to dry casks when it is cooled enough to do so. 5 years after spent fuel has been removed from the reactor core, it has cooled down sufficiently to be transferred from wet pool storage into dry cask storage. Dry casks are not absolutely safe, but their risk is so much lower than wet pool storage that it's simply irresponsible not to do so. Risk has two factors, the likelihood of an accident and the consequences from that accident should it occur. Dry cask storage reduces both of these factors and therefore reduces the overall risk even more. Dry cask storage reduces the amount of spent fuel stored in the wet pools. This in turn lowers the amount of heat emitted by the spent fuel to those pools, which translates into more time for workers to provide makeup water to a pool or restore cooling of that water, thus preventing an accident in the first place. But if an accident cannot be prevented, having less spent fuel stored in the pool reduces the size of the radioactive cloud emitted from that pool. The NRC's recommendations 7.1 through 7.5 address spent fuel pool concerns, but don't advocate the transfer of irradiated fuel into dry casks. Thus, the NRC's proposed actions, while good, remain insufficient to responsibly handle this known hazard. Our next key recommendation is to enforce fire protection regulations. This is the seventh recommendation from our full set. After a fire disabled all of the emergency core cooling systems on the Unit 1 reactor at Browns Ferry in Alabama and destroyed most of those systems for Unit 2, the NRC adopted fire protection regulations in 1980 intended to prevent another disastrous fire. Two decades later, the NRC's inspectors discovered that many reactors failed to meet those regulations. In 2004, the NRC adopted an alternative set of fire protection regulations. Today, the NRC has a list of nearly four dozen reactors across the United States that failed to meet either set of fire protection regulations. Four out of the five NRC commissioners recently voted to give these reactors more time, three more years, to operate with these known safety hazards and violations. It's not enough for the NRC to merely order safety nets. They must make sure that these safety nets are installed at the plants. Our next key recommendation is for the NRC to set timeliness goals for resolution of safety issues. This is the eighth recommendation from our full set. The NRC should set timeliness goals for resolving generic safety issues while continuing to meet its timeliness goals for business-related requests from reactor owners. For the past decade, the NRC has reported periodically to Congress on its goals to approve business-related requests by plant owners in a timely manner. Currently, those goals are to approve 95% of such requests within 1 year and 100% of such requests within 2 years. Last year, the NRC approved 93% within a year and met the goal of approving 100% within 2 years. The NRC should also set and meet goals for resolving known safety hazards. The NRC has been tracking five such generic safety hazards for the past 6 to 15 years for each of those five, with an average duration of over 10 years per known safety hazard. An agency that can approve 100% of requests for power uprates, reduced testing frequencies, and other nuclear business in less than 2 years, but cannot resolve known safety hazards in less than a decade, does not have the proper safety focus. It's said that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The NRC's near-term task force made many recommendations to lessen the vulnerability of U.S. reactors, but unless those good intentions or implemented in a timely manner, we may not be able to avoid the hell that was Fukushima. Ed will address the remaining recommendations.
Thanks, Dave. Our next top-line recommendation is something that UCS has been advocating for a long time, and that is strengthening the protection of nuclear plants against terrorist attack. Fukushima has given new urgency to this because it was a graphic demonstration of how a simultaneous failure of safety systems can lead rapidly to a severe event and core damage and radiological release. The kind of event that was caused by the earthquake and tsunami at Fukushima could be induced in a matter of minutes by an adversary team that has a rudimentary understanding of how the plant works. And so we need more than ever to have a robust security posture at nuclear power plants to protect against the threats that the U.S. faces against its infrastructure. However, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission shortchanges security by setting the level of protection at what industries should be expected or could be expected to pay for rather than what the maximum threat against the facility is. And as a result, there's a gap between what that maximum threat is and the level of security at nuclear power plants. Until that gap is closed, we are unnecessarily at risk from a sabotage attack at our nuclear plants. Optimally, the NRC's decision with regard to what's called the design basis threat needs to be reviewed by an interagency group with expertise from the intelligence community. And so there really needs to be an additional structure and review of how NRC sets policy for protection against terrorist attacks. The next issue I'd like to address are new reactors. It stands to reason that if we are going to be building new nuclear reactors in this country that will be around for 60 or 80 years, that they should be built to the highest safety standards. However, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has a longstanding policy that new reactors do not have to be safer than existing reactors, although they would like them to be safer, but they refuse to actually require them to be safer. And as a result, the U.S. is getting exactly what we've asked for, which is a fleet of new reactor designs, none of which actually demonstrate significantly enhanced safety. The NRC is being extremely misleading in the task force report. It suggests that passive designs like the AP1000, Westinghouse, and the ESBWR, which is General Electric, would automatically meet many of the task force's goals. But this is simply not true. In the event of a beyond design basis accident, the current requirements and characteristics of these new reactors, let's say for being able to withstand a three-day station blackout, would simply could not be met if, let's say, there were a concurrent beyond design basis seismic event that caused failure of the water supply. So it's simply not true to say that these reactors would automatically meet the protection against beyond design basis accidents that we think is necessary. Finally, I'd like to discuss a very important application of severe accident analysis that underlies a lot of NRC's regulatory decisions, and that is, for instance, how it makes decisions about how safe is safe enough, whether a new requirement is actually justified in light of the additional benefit it provides. The NRC does this through cost-benefit analysis, and it essentially weighs the cost of a safety improvement against the value of human life that would be saved through making that improvement. This is not unlike what other agencies do, but the NRC uses an unusually low value for human life, the value of human life, which is an outlier, well below what other agencies use and well below what the Office of Management Budget has imposed as a minimum. The NRC uses a value of $3 million for the value of a human life. That's been the same value undiscounted since the mid-90s. And as a result, many of the safety decisions that they're making based on this analysis are underestimating the value of the lives saved, and as a result, safety improvements that could be beneficial are not being made. And I will stop there. Thank you.
Ready to open up the phones to questions.
Certainly. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you wish to ask a question, please press the star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question is later answered, or you wish to remove yourself from the queue for any reason, you may press the pound key to do so. One moment while participants enter the queue. Our first question comes from the line of Peter Baer from ClimateWire.
Good afternoon, and thank you. And either Ed or David, if you've had a chance to read the task force report, do you have any conclusions about the process that the task force is recommending the NRC follow for making regulatory changes? They talk about a new regulatory framework. And so I'm wondering if you can explain, as you see it, how the task force proposes that the NRC go from here?
This is Dave. I'll take a start at that, and Ed can supplement it if necessary. It seemed like if I understood what the near-term task force was recommending, it was to try to integrate some of the various programs and policies that the NRC has been using over many years, the 9/11 upgrades, the TMI severe accident upgrades, the Chernobyl lessons learned in its normal reactor oversight process, try to integrate those so that to hopefully to eliminate any gaps. It's one thing to make sure that you've done this, but to make sure that it's sustained at that level, met that level of expectation, you need to periodically revisit it. And I think the NRC's framework was lacking that follow-up. And if I understand what they're trying to do, it's to pull them together, periodically touch all those bases to make sure that everything's still covered. I guess first to establish that it is covered and then to retain that assurance that it's covered as time goes forward. So I think that's, if I understand it right, and they achieve that, that's probably going to be a step forward.
Could I follow that then by asking, does this look to you like a process that would be carried out over a few months or possibly many months or even a year or more to do what they're talking about here?
Well, I think it's, if I understand what they've done, it's going to, some of the things are going to be done fairly short order. They're talking about using orders to implement some of the upgrades in a fairly expedited time frame. Some of them will take longer term. So I think it's we are concerned that the NRC needs to implement these measures as quickly as possible. It's good to see that they're not going to wait for the last one to be done before they're implementing some of the earlier ones, but we didn't see much in the way of an expectation of what their timelines were for completing these steps. So it's hard to judge the timeliness goals until they've established them.
Peter, if I could just add something. Certainly changing the framework and removing inconsistencies is an important first step, but the devil is really going to be in the details of how those changes are carried out. And so we remain concerned that until we see more details about the actual implementation, about the particular procedures and requirements that are going to be used to increase the scope of what's considered a design basis accident, we're going to remain concerned that there may still be problems in implementation. So we're maintaining a wait-and-see approach.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Brian Wingfield from Bloomberg News.
Hi, guys. Thanks for doing this. Excuse me. I'm just wondering if you might be able to say which of these recommendations might be easiest for industry to implement and what the cost may be and possibly which reactors may be most affected if the NRC takes this route.
This is Dave. I haven't put a price tag on the recommendations, so I don't know that one. I think the easiest one, or the one that could happen perhaps the quickest, would be the coming into compliance with fire protection regulations. Some plants have already done that, so the pathway has been defined. There shouldn't be any unanswered questions for the remaining plant owners to achieve that if they had the will to do so. I think that could be done. The NRC chairman at the Regulatory Information Conference back in March, just before the Japanese accident, was asked that question, and he felt that they could be doing it within a year. So hopefully that the first part of that here starts tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. What about on the other side of the spectrum? What would seem to be the costliest?
The first plant to go through that pipeline was the Sharon Harris plant in North Carolina, and I saw various estimates in the media where they claimed on one side it was costing them $10 million, and then I've also heard reports about the same time that said it was $30 million. So I'm not sure why there was such a wide range in reports there, but I think what Fukushima shows is the cost of not doing some of the upgrades. Whatever the cost is, it's relatively cheap insurance against those kind of disasters.
Thanks.
And this is Ed. I can tell you what I think some of the hardest ones are going to be, and certainly upsetting the apple cart with respect to emergency planning is something which the NRC seems loath to do. They ducked that in their own task force report and defended the status quo, more or less, at least with regard to the extent of the emergency planning zones. There's a strong interest in not expanding those zones and essentially notifying additional populations that they may be at risk from nuclear plant in their vicinity. So we expect that is also going to be a fight. Congressman Markey was instrumental in getting a law passed in 2002 that required the expansion of the distribution of potassium iodide from 10 miles to 20 miles around nuclear power plants. That was never implemented because the White House chose to enact a waiver and essentially block that measure. And so even this common sense measure has been stymied for the last decade practically.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of Margaret Hobson from Congressional Quarterly.
Hi, thanks for having this. Some members of Congress and some industry folks are saying that there really isn't enough information at this point. They haven't gotten, the NRC hasn't gotten enough detailed information about what happened at Fukushima for them to be coming out with these kinds of broad sweeping proposals at this point. Can you respond to that?
Yeah, this is Dave. The near-term task force report, a couple of recommendations recognize that. In the area of hydrogen control, to prevent the building explosions that demolished the Unit 1, 3, and 4 reactor buildings at Fukushima, the near-term task force report said there wasn't enough information available yet in order to determine what the right fix is. You really can't solve a problem until you've defined it. So they put a placeholder in there and said, whatever those actions are, that will be done in the follow-up phase of the NRC's work. They also did that in another area, topic escapes me, but in the areas they did address, there's already enough information known. The station blackout, the extended loss of power is well known. It's pretty known that the consequences of that were bad, and there's no need to wait for the final autopsy report to take steps now to protect the plants in the United States. So I think the NRC achieved the right balance between what it knows now and can act upon and what remains to be known and acted upon later. The task force report recognized that, and I think the industry and the members of Congress are wrong.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Ryan Tracy from Dow Jones.
Hello, thanks for having the call. I wonder if you could address two of the NRC's recommendations and how hard it might be to comply and how many plants we're talking about that would be affected by them. The two ones I'm interested in are the one about hardened vents and also the station blackout rules, the 8-hour and 72 hours to cool the reactor. Can you just give us some idea of what it's going to take to comply with those if they're implemented and how many plants we're talking about?
This is Dave. The first part of that, the hardened vent, would only apply to the 23 Mark I boiling water reactors and the 8 Mark II containment boiling water reactors, so a total of 31 plants. And even for those, the majority of those plants have already put in the hardened vent. The NRC's near-term task force report wanted to make sure that the ability to operate that hardened vent, to open up the valves when necessary, needs to be made more reliable. That was a problem at Fukushima, and that's a problem that can be solved here in the United States. The task force is recommending putting in remotely operated DC-powered, battery-powered controls for the vent valves so that it's when that need arises, it can be done. Some plants, I don't know the exact total, may have to put in that. I know some, like the Pilgrim plant in Massachusetts, already has battery-powered vent valves, remotely operated, so they may not have to do much. other plants that are not in that configuration may have to add the batteries and the controls to make that happen. The second part was the station blackout, the 8-hour and 72-hour duration. That really applies to all plants in the United States, all 104 reactors. As Ed mentioned earlier, it's the cost of that really determines on exactly how that's going to be done, how the 8-hour is going to be met, how the 72 hours is going to be met. Those details haven't been specified yet, so it's hard to put a price tag on that until that level of specificity is provided.
Thanks. And the issue of battery power controls for the vent valves, is that an expensive issue? Or?
I'm not volunteering to pay for it, but it's not, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not very expensive for a plant that's making $1 million a day or more in revenue, so it's,
okay.
It's a very modest cost for them.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of Roger Witherspoon from New Jersey Newsroom.
Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon, Roger.
Curious about the comments you made about the deficiencies in the AP1000 and the General Electric design. Could you elaborate a bit on those?
Yes. The NRC actually has a requirement that plants that have passive cooling systems, new reactors, have to be able to withstand the 72-hour loss of, total loss of power. But so that's essentially considered a design basis accident for those reactors. But as the NRC has pointed out, in their analysis of station blackouts writ large, they've not considered how that station blackout actually occurs. For instance, they haven't they didn't postulate that it was a large seismic event that caused failure of both the power grid and on-site power supplies. So for the same logic, they haven't actually required the plants to examine the context of that station blackout and whether the systems that they have in place to mitigate it for 72 hours would actually be functional in what's, in a beyond design basis type situation. So that 72-hour requirement is only within a limited scope and might not apply to a more severe accident. And once you get beyond 72 hours, there's a tank that supplies cooling water passively for that period of time, but after that time it has to be refilled. And so you're going to need operators and electricity to operate the pumps to refill that tank. So if you get into a space where your power is challenged for longer than that, it could be an issue. Now, the task force is restricting station blackout compliance for existing plants only to 72 hours. We're not sure where that number came from, but it is conveniently similar to what they're requiring for the new plants. But given the extended power supply issues that we saw at Fukushima, it's not clear that 72-hour requirement is adequate.
Okay. If I understand that correctly, and recalling the last interim report from the NRC, for example, they checked to see if there was fire equipment, but did not require that it be in a building that could withstand an earthquake. So if there was an earthquake, they might not be able to have the equipment.
Right.
Or the water coming into the complex, water pipes in the city's water system may be ruptured. Is that what you're referring to when they didn't look at context?
Yes, that's certainly an example. The right way to do it would be you start out with an event and think about all the ways that that event could have an impact on the situation. So, if you're talking about a beyond design basis seismic event, you look at all the ways that could disrupt the plant, its operations, emergency preparedness, evacuation planning. So you need to follow that through, and they have not done that. And that kind of analysis is really what should be needed as part of this greater effort to extend the regulatory framework to be consistent.
Of the suicide crash of a 767 or bigger, or did they just assume that can't happen?
Well, in that case, that's the one event that that equipment might actually be capable of being available for, because that's what it was designed to do. Now, are you talking about the AP1000 in particular?
Sure.
New plant designs are required to demonstrate that they can keep the fuel cool in the event of a crash of an aircraft. However, the specifics of that aircraft are not public. It's considered security-related information, so we don't actually know the size of the aircraft that they're being designed to withstand.
You know the speed?
Not
the NRC has been using a speed that they knew was inadequate. I'm sorry, the NEI, but I don't know about the NRC.
Right. Well, we don't know because that information is not public. So we know they're being designed to withstand some sort of plane crash, but not the specifics.
Roger, we should let someone else ask the question.
Okay.
We can follow up with you later, okay?
All right, buddy.
Thanks.
Our next question comes from Tom Henry, the Toledo Blade.
Yeah, just a two-part thing real quick, one for Ed and then one for Dave. First, I wondered, Ed, if you could clarify how population and other factors would come into establishing an emergency, a new emergency evacuation zone. I mean, since radiation doesn't care if it's going over a highly populated or a densely populated or sparsely populated area. And then I was going to ask Dave, too, about the spent fuel versus dry cask issue and how Yucca Mountain or any other repository comes into that, because it seems like there's going to be, if there's a move to more frequent use of dry cask storage, that seems to be a much more decentralized approach, which would have ramifications for a national repository if one's ever going to be built, and then questions might arise about are we building are there going to be excessive carbon emissions from overbuilding concrete and steel and roads for these additional dry casks?
Thanks, Tom. For the first part of your question, it's a good question. What I mean is that there needs to be an acknowledgement that the consequences of a large radiological release are determined by a combination of meteorology and population distribution. And so the most severe consequences can occur when, let's say, the highest probability wind direction is in the direction of a densely populated area. Take Indian Point near New York City. The prevailing winds are predominantly northerly, meaning they flow toward the city. And so as a result, that's even though the city is 25, 30 miles away, because of that, because of the wind direction, that's particularly high risk. However, another plant, it may be prevailing winds blow away from population centers. So there really needs to be just a site-specific tailored approach to understand those particular risks and then tailor the evacuation planning and emergency planning to that specific site. So just use all the information available, best available modeling tools to understand it, rather than just to draw a generic 10-mile ring around every plant.
Somebody argue that you're overanalyzing it by being that site-specific if you were, if 10 miles is not adequate, what's wrong with setting a 20, 30, or 50-mile zone, and even if you have to modify some of the way things are done right now, because you don't know from day to day how, even though they're prevailing winds, you don't know what the conditions are at any given time.
Yeah, absolutely, and that might be the right answer. You also have to understand the uncertainties. And if the uncertainties are big enough, then it may make sense not to get specific. You shouldn't try to be more specific than your data and your error bars allow you to be. So, but I just mean thinking harder about these issues than they have in the past.
Okay. And Tom, to address the second part of the second question on spent fuel, the NRC's task force report says that the average spent fuel pool in the United States has approximately 3,000 fuel assemblies in it, and the spent fuel pools at Fukushima had 200 to 500, 550, 580, something like that, fuel assemblies in it.
An average of 3,000?
Per spent fuel pool.
Is that assemblies or?
Assemblies, 3,000 assemblies per pool.
On the average in the U.S.? And Fukushima had about 200 to 300, you said?
200 to 500, mid-500s, depending on the reactor. And that's related to the point you made. Because the federal government hasn't provided a repository for the long-term or permanent disposal of spent fuel, it's stacked up at the power plants. The federal government's compounding that error by improperly managing that hazard at the plant sites. You know, if two wrongs don't make a right, the federal government shouldn't be trying to figure out how many wrongs it does take to make a right. That's not what the cliché is aimed at. The right thing to do is to transfer that fuel out of the pools into dry casks. We also have, it's not one of our key eight recommendations, but one of the full set of recommendations is to better protect the dry casks once they're out on that storage pad out bad, by putting some kind of berm or something around it so it's out of line of sight so the bad guys can't fire a rocket-propelled grenade or something else at the cask. You mentioned something about that, you know, there is – how do you do centralized – how do you do interim storage, I guess, on a more – rather than a site-specific basis across the country? At the plants that have been permanently shut down, such that the spent fuel is the only hazard remaining on site, the reactor has been decommissioned and everything else, at those sites it might make sense to consolidate the dry cask onto a single site or a handful of sites rather than have all these orphan sites around the country. For the plants that are continuing to operate reactors, it makes sense to leave the dry cask at those sites because the infrastructure is already there, the security force is there, and some of the other attendant things that you need are already there to support the reactor. They can best be extended to also protect the dry casks that are stored on site. I don't think anybody's advocating wasting carbon emissions by building casks or pans that aren't being used. The utility companies don't want to spend that money any more than anybody else wants to see that the carbon gas is released, but something has to be done until the federal government figures out what to do with spent fuel.
Well, just as a quick follow-up, I mean, isn't this, you know how politically difficult it's been to this point getting a national repository built, and then if things become more decentralized, wouldn't the country essentially be giving up on a national repository? What would be the incentive for a repository, other than the fact that the utilities don't like the liability of having something on site there, even if it's less dangerous than it is now?
That's a good point, and many communities have expressed that when companies got to the point of going to dry cask storage. Many communities, the Waterford, Connecticut, and others have been concerned that those were becoming de facto repositories in the absence of an overall federal program. There's some truth to that. The fuel has remained on site longer than anybody ever expected it to. And with the current impasse, it looks like the status quo is going to be maintained for some time. We think that means what that suggests is that the known hazard of irradiated fuel stored in wet pools is going to be around for a while. So we need to take steps to better manage that risk rather than wait for some disaster to then compel us into taking the steps that we should have been taking already.
Next question, please.
Our next question comes from the line of Amy Harder from National Journal.
Hi, thanks so much for holding this call. I have two related questions. Congress needs to take any action in response to this report, or is there anything specific that could be congressionally mandated in order to ensure some of these regulations get implemented? And then on a bigger picture, bigger level question, how do you think this bodes for the industry moving forward? Of course, no plant has been built, no reactor has been built in 30 years. Only one conditional loan guarantee has been given out. Do you think all this scrutiny on the safety should compel Congress and administration to rethink its policy on nuclear power? Thank you.
This is Dave. Well, I think the Congress is the one that required the NRC to submit the periodic reports on its how it meets its business goals. The Congress could also, I've testified for Congress in the past, asking that they also hold the NRC accountable for resolving known safety issues. Thus far, the Congress hasn't done that, but it could as a way to see these safety issues get resolved rather than just logged periodically. The second part of that question. Could you repeat it? Just refresh the second
part. Yeah, it would.
I can take that one.
Okay, go ahead.
Let's just put it this way. I mean, it's in everyone's interest to make sure that nuclear power is as safe as possible. I mean, Fukushima turned public opinion against nuclear power in Japan overnight. I think the prime minister even said today they should think about a non-nuclear future, and this is unthinkable. And so, you know, the advocates of nuclear power in the administration, Congress, really have to think about, unless they support enhanced safety, whether they might be sabotaging their own plans. So it's really something that's incumbent on everyone to work together to make sure nuclear power is as safe as possible. Now, the problem is that more safety generally entails higher cost. It's not necessarily true, but certainly the easiest way to make things safer is to spend more money, and that could well have an impact on the cost of nuclear power, which is already, as you know, not competitive and requires significant subsidy to get off the ground in this country. So, but it's something you really can't shortchange if we're going to make sure that nuclear power is safe enough to be sustainable.
One quick follow-up question. The report today said that these recommendations aren't going to affect the relicensing process at the NRC. Is that a finding that you agree with, or do you think that the relicensing process needs to be reexamined in terms of these safety recommendations?
This is Dave. I tend to agree with that NRC finding. More than two-thirds of the plants in the United States have already been relicensed. So it's any lessons learned from Japan have to be applied to all the plants that are vulnerable, not just the ones that are last in the license renewal line. So I tend to agree with that NRC finding that whatever lessons are to be learned need to be applied to all the reactors, not just those Johnny-come-latelys.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Edward Felker from Energy Guardian.
Thanks. My question has been answered.
Our next question comes from the line of Yan Meiji from Plant.
Hi. Thank you, Ed and Dave. First, I have a specific question to Ed. You said that NRC has been lowballing the value of human lives compared to the OMB requirement and other agencies. Do you have the number for the OMB minimum as well as maybe an average of the values other agencies use?
Yes, I'm referring. There was actually a story in the New York Times earlier this year that discussed this issue, and I believe it was OMB said that $5 million should be the floor for agency determinations, and that some agencies went up to as much as $9 million. But you might want to go back and look at that story to get the more details. But that's my recollection.
Okay. Another more general question to both of you. Do you guys, other than releasing your recommendations publicly, do you have plans, follow-up steps to make sure or push the NRC to adopt and implement some of the recommendations you guys have?
This is Dave. We were somewhat disappointed that the task force did not meet with the public during its deliberations. We had been told that in order to meet that tight schedule that they weren't going to meet with external stakeholders. But page 2 of the NRC's report says that they met with the Institute for Nuclear Power Operations, which is an external stakeholder but not the public. So they have alluded to at some point in the public, some point in the future, to actually meeting with the public. We intend to make full opportunity of those meetings to express what we thought was good in the report and what we thought might have been doing, achieving the same goal a slightly different way. So we do tend to follow up and also with the Congress, which is one of the players as well.
Thank you.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone. Our next question comes from the line of Patricia Dodona from the Day of Connecticut.
Hi, Dave and Ed. This is Pat.
Hi, Pat.
I have two questions that are related. Since the NRC task force is proposing regulatory changes, what would it take to implement them in a timely way? And secondly, what incentive is there for reactor owners to make changes ahead of that process?
Well, I'll start with a fact, and that's we don't want this to be a repeat of what happened after the September 11th attacks, when all of a sudden NRC realized that its approach to protection of plants against sabotage was seriously deficient, yet it took years to establish to come to a consensus with industry about how far they should go in enhancing those requirements, and it's taking even additional years to actually fully implement them, so that even today there are a number of plants that have not fully complied with post-September 11th requirements. So we don't think that this process this process better not take as long, because it's simply an unacceptable delay. And I'll let Dave follow up.
Your other part of your question, Pat, was, I agree with what Ed said on the first, but on the other part was, what's the incentive for plant owners to get ahead of the NRC on some of this? That's a very good question, because when I worked in the industry down at the Grand Gulf nuclear plant, that plant owner chose to not wait for the NRC and go ahead and do something to address a safety issue. They paid a lot of money, did that, and then the NRC found that that's not what they wanted. They wanted a blue one instead of a green one, and the company then had to spend some more money to justify why the green one was equally safe. So one of the ways the NRC can avoid that, and the industry can avoid being put in or repeating that trap, was for the NRC to act in an expeditious manner. The NRC comes through and identifies what its expectations are. The industry can go out and meet those expectations without uncertainty, without being surprised. The NRC can then verify that those actions met its expectations. It's when the NRC, as Ed pointed out, takes a long time and deliberates and ponders and flip-flops around, that no one gains. The plant owners don't win, the NRC doesn't win, and most of all, the American public doesn't win. So the NRC needs to move expeditiously on its list of recommendations to make sure that these safety and security fixes are made and not debated for the next decade.
Our next question comes from the line of Ann Payne from the Tennessee.
Thank you. I was just wondering, when you mentioned plants not meeting fire regulations and maybe something else, how the TVA stands with its plants, if it's on those lists.
Yeah, this is Dave Lockbaum. Ironically, the Bronze Ferry plant that started all the fire protection regulations years ago is three of the reactors that don't meet either set of regulations. On our UCS website, we have a tool called the Nuclear Power Information Tracker. From that Nuclear Power Information Tracker, there's a number of things that you can sort the plants in the country by, the type of reactor or those that have elevated spent fuel pool. One of the things that you can call out of that database are the reactors that don't meet fire protection regulations. Right now there's 50 of them if you select that. And I don't recall if the Sequoia and Wasp plants are also on that list or not, but Nuclear Power Information Tracker would provide that answer.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Eileen O'Grady from Reuters.
Thanks a lot. The NEI said this morning that they don't see these initial recommendations as causing any plants to shut. If that's, do you think that's true? And if that's true, are they sufficient enough? Do you think, you know, that some should be shut?
This is Dave. Somewhere in the NRC's report, and it seems like it was early on, they basically came, the NRC came to that conclusion also. They said that the vulnerabilities that have been identified by the accident and its lessons learned don't have any immediate safety implications at U.S. plants. In that, I guess that translates into NEI believing that none of the plants will be shut down. I would tend to agree with that, but on the flip side of that, that's not, that doesn't mean there's an open-ended time frame for resolving these issues. Right now, it's basically high-stakes poker. If a problem affects one of our plants that haven't had these upgrades, the American public's going to take a very dim view of the federal government having known about these problems but not causing them to be fixed. And as Ed alluded to earlier, a disaster at a plant when you knew what needed to be fixed but didn't do it would be the end of nuclear power in the United States. Nobody would let them play again. So it's in the industry and the NRC's best interests to very expeditiously solve these problems that they've identified and rather than continue to debate them indefinitely.
Thanks a lot.
Our next question comes from the line of Brian Lawson from the Huntsville Times.
Hey, guys. I'm sorry if you spoke to this earlier and I missed it. Speaking about the dry cast storage, you know, I'm interested mostly in TVA, but I'm wondering about the cost difference between putting it in the dry cask, as you recommend, as opposed to leaving them in the spent fuels as it exists today. I don't mean so much from a risk standpoint, but strictly just from a operating cost kind of concern.
This is Dave Lockwell. I don't have those numbers right offhand, but Bob Alvarez at the Institute for Public Policy, I think that's it, in Washington, D.C., issued
Institute
a report.
Institute for Policy Studies.
Thanks, Ed. Bob Alvarez offered a report just a few weeks ago that looked at the cost of dry cask storage, how long it would take, how much it would cost, and I refer you to that report for those numbers because it did a very good job covering those issues.
Let me ask you one follow-up. The other thing that NRC talked about in its recommendations was the hardening of the venting system. You were talking about 50 plants, you know, are outside the fire rigs. What about the venting as it stands today? Are most facilities, are they meeting that standard, or is it all over the map, or how far away are they?
This is Dave. 30 of the 31 plants, and those 31 plants are the boiling water reactors with either Mark 1 containments, of which there are 23, or Mark 2 containments, of which there are 8. 30 of those 31 reactors have installed a hardened vent. The only one that hasn't is the Fitzpatrick plant in upstate New York. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is going beyond the hardened vent because it's not enough to have a hardened vent if you can't operate to open the valves to utilize that hardened vent. And that was one of the problems at Fukushima. So the NRC is suggesting or recommended that the plant owners install, improve the reliability of the overall system so that it can be used when it needs to be used. I've not looked at all of those designs. I've looked at some of them. The Pilgrim plant in Massachusetts is well on its way towards meeting that. It has battery-powered, remotely operated vent valves that provide not a guarantee, but some assurance that the operators will be able to open them when the need arises. Other plants don't have that. We've also looked at some that have that are AC-powered, alternating current-powered. That was the problem that started the accident at Fukushima. If you don't have power, you can't open the vent valves. So I think the NRC's task force was right in recommending that that's a vulnerability. I think it's not a one-size-all-fits-all solution because the different plants have chosen to implement the hardened vents in different ways.
Okay. Thank you.
Question comes from the line of Craig Miller from KQED.
Thanks. I wonder if using your own recommendations as a benchmark for the best way forward, placing those side by side with the task force recommendations that came out, if you had to give them a letter grade overall, what would it be?
I'd give ours an A.
Right, I was assuming that. So okay. Placing theirs side by side.
We haven't done a thorough enough assessment of the NRC yet to be able to come to a conclusion. But I'd like to point out that ours and theirs had a different scope. Theirs were focused specifically on issues that were revealed through Fukushima. And we took a broader view of the whole landscape. So they're not directly comparable. And as far as our assessment of the task force, again, it's really going to depend on the implementation details to some extent. We think they left some things out. Some things look flat wrong. But it's too early for us to make an overall assessment.
Well, that's actually okay. That's where I was going, is in the left out or flat wrong category. Can you call some of those out?
Well, with regard to emergency planning in particular, I was disappointed that they seemed to fall back on the status quo with regard to the size of the emergency planning zone, the policy on potassium iodide distribution. They just went back to their boilerplate language, and we think they are still refusing to grapple with that issue because it's one that's so hard that they maybe don't want to take it on. But to imply that there's no threat, let's say, from the absorption of radioactive iodine from the plume beyond 10 miles from the site is contradicted by the analysis that they did right after Fukushima to support their 50-mile evacuation recommendations. So they're just not being consistent. Their spent fuel recommendations also, the NRC and the industry are strongly opposed to any new requirements that would lead to accelerated transfer of spent fuel from pools to dry casks, and their recommendations reflect that and that they haven't, they didn't deal with it, but we think that's a major oversight.
I'd add to what Ed said, that on a spent fuel pool, what the task force recommended was just to provide some highly reliable way of providing makeup water to a spent fuel pool to replace the water that's being lost due to evaporation if the pool starts to boil. At roughly a third of the reactors in the United States, that would, if achieved, would protect the fuel that's in the spent fuel pool from damage, but it would basically destroy the reactor along the way because the spent fuel pool was located in the reactor building, as at Fukushima. If you're providing 100 gallons of makeup water to a boiling spent fuel pool, there's 100 gallons of steam vapor that's going to condense and drain down into the basement of the reactor building where the emergency equipment for cooling the reactor is located. That equipment doesn't work well underwater, so you may save the fuel that's in the spent fuel pool, but you sacrifice the reactor in doing so. Our way would basically try to save both the spent fuel and the reactor and not force the operators to make the hard choice of which one melts down.
Okay, thank you, John.
Our next question comes from the line of Tom Henry from the Toledo Blade.
Yeah, another question I had was the issue of metal embrittlement and material reliability. Most of the things that are addressed right now seem to be known problems, fire hazards and, evacuation zones and dry cast versus wet storage. And I know this is kind of a touchy issue to the NRC because nobody really knows from an engineering standpoint how much stress metal can withstand if, a 40-year life expectancy for reactor wondering to what degree material reliabilities and metal embrittlement should have been, or was, or should have been addressed in a report like this, because it seems like, you know, that's pretty fundamental for where entering into uncharted water now, so to speak, with this industry, where we're going if we're trying to make it as robust safety-wise as we can. It almost seems like it cries for a better synergy between how how reliable the equipment's going to be.
Yeah, Tom, I would agree with that. And I think Ed kind of gave an explanation for why the NRC didn't cover it. They pretty much focused in on lessons learned from Fukushima directly with that narrowed scope. In our recommendations, which were more sweeping than that, our recommendations 10 and 11, for example, speak to better ways the Nuclear Regulatory Commission could manage the hazard from aging equipment. Recommendation 10 recommended that plant owners use multiple inspection techniques. Plants have had problems looking for cracks in steam generator tubes that they missed, or inspecting for flaws that the method they used was masked for whatever reason and didn't see a crack that was there. So we recommended using multiple inspection techniques to provide greater assurance that if a crack is there or a degradation exists, that you find it. Recommendation 11 recommends that plant owners periodically inspect equipment outside the scope of what they normally do. You know, they don't look at every foot of pipe or every inch of cable. They do what are called smart samples, but they're constantly finding stuff breaking outside of those, where they've drawn the boundaries on those boxes. So we're suggesting that maybe 10% of the inspections be outside the scope, hopefully to confirm that you've drawn the boundaries in the right place and places are degrading where you think they will, or to identify the shortcomings in your guesses as early as possible so they can be remedied before they grow to epidemic proportions. So those collectively, those recommendations would attempt to address aging issues broadly, which include material degradation and material properties.
But you would agree that more should be done at the NRC level in terms of looking outside the box and in these areas?
Well, I think, yeah, both the NRC, the industry as well, because the industry has that materials reliability project that's been working for a while, but I don't think it's ready to fold its tent yet and claim victory. There's still too many surprises that are plaguing the industry.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other questions?
Our last question comes from the line of Roger Witherspoon from the New Jersey Newsroom.
Hi. One more. When you're talking about backup power, would you explain the difference between the capabilities of the spent fuel pool safety systems and the reactor's safety systems? I was under the impression that your spent fuel pools, particularly in pressurized water reactors, were not designed to use batteries or diesel generators, and the fact that the plant may have 4 8-hour batteries is irrelevant to the spent fuel pools. Could you fill me in on just exactly what their capabilities are?
Sure. The plants were not required to have the capability to have the cooling water, the spent fuel pool cooling system, which includes the spent fuel pool pumps, plus the cooling system that cools the heat exchangers in the spent fuel pool cooling system. The original design requirements weren't, owners weren't required to have diesel capability, emergency diesel generator power supplies for those spent fuel pool cooling systems. Despite that, some owners have the capability of having their emergency diesel generators power that equipment, so the spent fuel pool could be cooled even if the connection to the offsite grid were lost, which is the normal source of power for that equipment. None of the plants in the United States that I'm aware of has the ability to cool the spent fuel pool water if only battery power is available. It's a very minimal subset of equipment, basically a steam-driven system for the coolant to reactors, all you've got at any plant. Part of the reason for that is the relatively short coping duration, a few hours. It's not assumed that the spent fuel pool water can reach the point of boiling and evaporate to the point of exposing the fuel in the 4 or 8 hour coping duration that plants are required to be operated on batteries. So that's part of the rationale why there's no such capabilities for the spent fuel pool cooling systems. One of the things that the Japanese Energy Task Force recommended was to correct a problem when all of the irradiated fuel from the reactor is offloaded into the spent fuel pools. Currently, when you're in that configuration, as Fukushima Unit 4 was on that tragic day, U.S. requirements don't even require water to be in the spent fuel pools. The requirements for containment, the requirements for power, the requirements for a number of things just go away altogether when you've totally offloaded the reactor core into the spent fuel pool. The task force thought that that was a mistake, and that was something they want to address fairly quickly.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Daniel, are there any other questions?
There are no further questions in the queue.
Okay, well, I guess we're done. Thank you very much for participating this afternoon. If you have any follow-up questions, please get in touch with our media shop. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance in today's conference. This does conclude today's program, and you may now disconnect. Have a nice day.